Welcome to the 385th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome, and thank you for listening. I hope you had a good holiday. I am week two post the Brazos Bend 50-mile run. Getting back to normal, back to running this week. First week, I just took Sophie for a walk, and this week I'm back to running with Sophie, about three and a half miles today. Just gradually start to tick it up again as we go. Feeling pretty good. Nothing really hurts too bad. Lost a couple toenails as usual, but nothing out of the ordinary. Wouldn't be normal if I didn't lose a couple toenails. Nutrition's been about the same. I'm just a little bit surprised. Not really too much more hungry than I would have been after any other race. I thought maybe I would really be trying to replete calories, but not really. So overall, feel pretty good. Next race for us is in June, the Leadville Marathon. So that should be interesting. It's going to be at 10,000 feet and going to 13,000 total. So it's hard to train for that here in flat Florida, but we'll see what happens. Do a little start to add a little strength training back in now that my legs aren't sore. This week was the Boston Marathon. For any of you that follow running at all, and to me, it's very inspirational. Boston is one of the oldest marathons in the country, and you have to qualify to get into Boston. I qualified in 2019, I believe, and then the pandemic came around. But this year was special. It was the 50th anniversary, and there was a runner named Val Rogaszewski. She ran in the 1972 marathon, and she completed it this year with her two daughters in the 75 to 79 age group with a time of 6 hours and 38 minutes. The oldest person in the 80-plus oldest woman, 5 hours and 23 minutes. Congratulations, Joanne McAllister. So it's pretty inspiring to see the best of the best. The men's race was won by Sherbet Evans at a time of 2 hours and 6 minutes. The first U.S. guy, Scott Faubel, ran a fabulous race, and he set a record for himself at 2 hours and 8 minutes and 52 seconds. And the most impressive thing about him was that the race he actually ran negative splits. I mean, he ran the second half faster. He ran a very, very smart race. The Kenyans took off, and he didn't really go chasing, so he didn't have the blow-up that a lot of people do. And he was, came in without a big sponsor and just ran a really, really solid race. So hats off to him. The women's race winner was Paris Jepeshir, and she ran in 2 hours and 21 minutes. She and the second place finisher, who was Abidel Yeshia, were neck and neck the whole last, several miles, which for a marathon is just unheard of. The lead changed several times, so it was actually very, very exciting. So if you haven't checked that out, you can check out some YouTubes. Pretty exciting. Got me ready to train and ready to run, maybe want to run a little faster, which was actually kind of dangerous because this is usually the time that I manage to injure myself because I want to go back out and run too soon. I want to push it a little bit too hard, and I've gotten into trouble, so I'm trying to play it smart this time and come back. I'm coming back from an unknown territory after having run 50 miles. It's kind of funny in my head now, 26 doesn't seem that bad, but So we'll see how things go, but certainly no speed work for me for a little bit. Since this is the Plant-Based Wellness Podcast, I need to get back to some nutrition. It is blueberry season in Florida, and we have some you pick 'em places around here. Next up, fruit for us is mango. I've been still getting my mamay sapota from Miami, which I have been enjoying. So my morning fruit is mango. Yellow dragon fruit, if you haven't had that, you should try it. Papaya, blueberries, grapes, and the mamay. So that's been, it's this time of year in Florida where I really start to have a lot of fun. still having to buy mangoes. The mangoes are on the trees, aren't ripe yet, but I'm watching them. And I can't wait to try some of our mangoes that some of our trees, it's the first year that they're actually producing. Backyard, we have some kale, Swiss chard, beets going. We've got parsley, fennel, basil, and daikon radishes. The daikon radish has actually flowered and gone to seed, and I didn't realize this, but you can actually eat the seed pods. They look like little green beans. So we're kind of collecting those to have some daikon radish seeds in a stir fry. Tower Garden has green peppers and tomatoes galore. I've got cherry tomatoes, the bigger, tomatoes about the size of 50-cent piece, and then some bigger heirloom tomatoes. So it's actually very prolific right now. So that's exciting. So everything I'm eating almost has to have tomatoes in it. And it's nice to have fresh tomatoes. So tonight I had a dish with asparagus, tomatoes, mushrooms, red pepper, tofu, artichokes, red onion. And I did some tofu along with some rice. I seasoned it with oregano, garlic, and thyme. For Easter dinner, we had green beans with tomatoes and mushrooms, along with the seitan tofu roast and some black-eyed peas and sweet potatoes. We also made some fresh salsa with the tomatoes and had burrito night. So we're getting the tomatoes about every day. Of course, tomatoes in the salad, tomatoes raw. It's kind of fun to go out and just pick a few tomatoes and eat while we're getting ready to play ball or, with the dog. So that's all good. One of the reasons why I like long distance running and ultras is that it mimics life in general and the struggles and the speed bumps that you incur. And I'm currently reading a book by Addie Bracey about the mental aspects of long distance running. And one of the things that she talks about is the why. And if you've ever spoken with our registered dietitian or myself, and I've talked about it on this podcast before, the why is very important as far as actually accomplishing something, knowing why you're actually doing it and having a good foundation and a good understanding of why you're doing something. If somebody else wants you to do something, pretty little chance of success. And that's really what she starts out with the book in, is that, you know, the stronger the why is, the higher the chance of success. And a lot of times people come in and they want their spouse to become plant-based, and they may need to become plant-based. And of course, I think everybody needs to become plant-based, but they have health reasons, but they don't see it that way. That's not their why. And, you know, I hear the reasons, you know, the vague reasons for becoming plant-based. I want to get healthy, or I want to lose weight. And they're good whys, certainly, but they're not specific enough to last through the temptations of other perhaps whys and what drives you. So, I think it's a good idea when you're first becoming plant-based is to really, you know, make a list and keep that list kind of handy as to why you're doing it. If it's to get off medication, then list your medications. List the ones you think you can potentially get off of. Discuss it with your physician over the time frame or what it would take to get you off of those medications. If it's a cholesterol medicine, what do you agree would be a good cholesterol with your physician that you could stop your medication? When can you stop some of your blood pressure medicines? A lot of physicians are very reluctant to stop medications because people rebound. But, you know, having that written down and having that goal to be able to stop those medications and why and when really can make a difference. If your why is not central and kind of in front of you all the time, I think it's very tempting to have, again, other things come up. I heard today, reasons why people tend to fail or not be able to stick with plant-based nutrition or good food choices. And, you know, sometimes it's trying too hard, too quick, and the disappointment that things don't work out and people just don't have the confidence and they give up. But I think the other thing people haven't thought about is what are they going to have to do to make the change, and what kind of obstacles are going to come in the way of making the change? Is it going out to dinner with your friends? Is it family stressors? Is it cooking your own food? And is it travel? And how are you going to deal with it? And what are you willing to sacrifice in order to get those goals? Frankly, some people aren't willing to make those sacrifices, and they try to keep a foot in both camps. They want to please their family and eat what their family eats, and you know, maybe not really declare their convictions, and I'll just eat around, and it becomes too tempting. A lot of times when family members have foods around that aren't on the plan, the conversation hasn't occurred that, you know, I'm going to need some help doing this, so can you keep some of this junk food perhaps in a bin out of my sight, you know, keep it in the pantry so I don't have to look at it. And then it becomes, well, what if they say, you know, this is my choice and I need to be able to have my things where I want it and have my choice. And I think that's where defining your why becomes very, very important. It's like, all right, I'm going to, you know, I'm putting a line around this. These are the things I can't do in order to achieve my why. And these are the sacrifices I'm willing to make. And perhaps define it. You know, again, going out to dinner, eating out with friends, but perhaps in the beginning it's sacrificing taste a little bit. We get very caught up in very sweet things, very salty things, and fatty things. I've had people in my class, something's missing, and it's the salt that, you know, they're used to having things very salty, or they miss the crunch of the fat. Or I have had a big sweet tooth, and so fruit in the beginning was just not sweet enough for me. I just, you know, it just didn't seem something that was gonna cut it for me, and it took a while. And again, I had to define my why. If I wanted to just be vegan, I could eat vegan sweets. But to refine it further, to get to my goals, to decrease risk of diabetes, to decrease risk of and lean up, it required me going more, you know, more and more to whole foods. And now, you know, fruit seems fine to me. So you have to kind of, you know, realize that things aren't going to necessarily taste exactly the way they used to, nor do you really want them to, because you're trying to get away from that. And how can you find a new acceptable taste pattern that you can live with? You know, I've heard, well, it's boring. You know, that's a perception. I'm not sure it's necessarily accurate, because it doesn't have to be. But simple is and can be boring, but it can also be a very good thing, because it doesn't take long to make something. So keeping things simple can make it easier. Greens, beans, and a grain or a potato, you know, simple fruits just cut up. And if you do it long enough, it becomes second nature, and it becomes something that you start to enjoy. And you just have to start and do a little bit at a time. When I have people start on an exercise program, you know, we talk about go out 5 minutes and come back 5 minutes. So regardless, put your clothes out the night before. Get up, go out the door, just say, I'm going out for 5 minutes, turn around, come back 5 minutes. If you do that nutritionally, you plan your food, you go buy the food, I'm going to have this, and I'm going to start with this, and, you know, I'm going to give myself the option, perhaps, you know, the first week, I'm just going to do breakfast, or I'm going to do breakfast and lunch, and that's what I'm going to do. It may take that as a transition. I'm going to eliminate salt. And you can't eliminate salt completely, but you're going to eliminate added salt. You're going to eliminate processed foods that have a lot of salty things. Look for specific ingredients that you're not going to do. Put some hard lines in the sand. I'm not going to do things with palm oil. I'm not going to do things with, you know, a bunch of extra added oil. I'm going to actually look at the oil content and things. I'm not going to snack on nuts. I'm going to snack on fruit instead. I'm going to try to sit down with my plate and make things, you know, have three meals and sit down there and look at my plate and make sure that it has the nutrients available, and I know what and to know why I'm eating what I'm eating, and be happy that those food choices right there on the plate is going to satisfy your health goals. It's one of the reasons why I try to have mushrooms multiple nights of the week. I order mushrooms from misfit.com. I'm not sponsored by them, but they have a lot of different varieties of mushrooms that I can get, so I can have different mushrooms in different dishes throughout the week. A lot of anti-cancer properties. Tomatoes, a lot of anti-cancer properties. Vitamin C, very, very good for you. Red peppers, again, beta-carotene, color, you know, red peppers, orange peppers, yellow peppers. Vitamin A, again, beta-carotene, a lot of other antioxidants. So I'm looking for these things when I'm preparing my food to make sure I have those tofu, soy products, anti-estrogen, my fruit, the different colored fruits, for stomach protection, for the resveratrols, the purples, the polyphenols. You know, I'm looking at my food to make sure it has that. And I can also look at other foods and say it doesn't have that. So, you know, if I want some plant-based bar or something, what is it actually going to do for me? That's not going to be part of my healthful diet if I have that. So am I going to make up for it, or am I going to eliminate it? How am I going to deal with that? And which ones would I possibly accept on occasion? And are they getting in the road of my caloric restriction that I you know, or the caloric count that I want to maintain a certain weight? So those are questions you should ask when you're actually looking at your plate and keeping that why you're trying to get somewhere. Somebody came into my office this week and was wearing a monitor that gives them, and it's the rage now on the internet to get monitors that you can see your glucose 24/7, you know, wearable devices. But they hadn't looked at any of the numbers in the wearable device. So they had no idea what the wearable device was telling them, and they were not using, nor was their physician, using that wearable device to adjust their diet or adjust perhaps even their medications. So the feedback that you get from either getting on the scale or taking your blood pressure or taking your glucose should be feedback used in real time to adjust what you're eating in order to achieve your goals. When we have diabetics and you do a hemoglobin A1C, it's basically the average of the glucose that are, it's attached to the hemoglobin, and your blood cells turn over about 3 months. So it's a 3 month average, and we can see what's happening. And that tells us, you know, again, that whole time period, but day-to-day glucose is three hours after dinner, glucose is in the morning, give us a feedback. Weights give us a feedback. If somebody's retaining fluid, if you up 3 pounds overnight, you didn't eat 3 pounds of food, it's water retention. So you have to do something different to change it. So if you're trying to get off of diabetic medications, you've got to have that feedback that you adjust to on a daily basis. Putting yourself in dietary jail is not the way to do it, however. It is, how do I make my plate good so that this good, wholesome plate at breakfast, lunch, and dinner allows me to get to my goals? There was a study that came out this week that looked at intermittent eating or intermittent fasting had no improved effect on weight loss. A lot of times people think that they can eat in a certain window, and because they're only eating in a certain window of time, that they'll eat less. But the reality of it is most people manage to get their calories in, whether they eat once a day, a restricted time, or 3 times a day. And, you know, most people that I've talked to, myself included, if I've gone for all day long and not eaten, when I do eat, I'm hungry and I tend to overeat because I just don't get full, and I'm eating quicker than I'm assessing myself to see if I'm full or not. So I'm not a fan of intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating. I'm a fan of sitting down with your plate and assessing what's on that plate, make sure it's nutrient-dense. Because if you eat 3 times a day, you can get an idea in those 3 plates that you're getting all your nutrients in. If you're grazing, your body, one, never gets a chance to settle out and not be digesting, and you don't have a good idea of what you've consumed. If you're eating continuously in this certain period of time, people tend not to be conscious of at what they're eating at all, so they're just, you know, I'm going to not eat till I go out to eat, and I'll eat what I want. And so you don't have an idea of what you're eating and how it affects glucose, how it affects the actual individual nutrient-dense items that you have on your plate. Did you get your beans for the day? Did you get grains for the day? Did you get fruit for the day? You know, did you get a colorful plate? You know, what colors did you have? Did you have greens today? You know, what kind of herbs did you have? They count as well as far as antioxidant, what kind of anti-cancer foods did you get in today? If you're, you know, looking at blood pressure, sodium is so important. Where did I get in salt today? You can't measure that if there's a few chips here and a bar here and something here and there. You can't possibly know how that happened. But if you make a meal, sit down with it, you can assess that meal, you can assess the second meal, you can assess the third meal. I like it when there are aha moments. I told you a few weeks ago when I hurt my, a couple months ago now, and I hurt my little toe, and I was talking to the podiatrist about how I hit my shoes, and I started looking about how my toes bend, and I've been working on foot and toe mobility since that time. And, you know, I'm always learning something about my gait and running and trying to figure ways to, you know, to hit better, to be more efficient. You know, I wasn't a runner in high school or college, not really had much in the way of training. So it's been something that I've kind of enjoyed figuring out on my own. And the same thing goes with, you know, and a lot of times, you know, I learn things from various people for various reasons, that aha moments. And this week I learned a tip for my back. I tend to get a tired thoracic spine. My upper back gets tired when I'm prepping, especially end of a long day or if I've been out running or doing yard work and then I'm in prepping at the kitchen sink, my upper back hurts. And it always, I've been working on mobility with 10 or 15 minutes of yoga at night with spinal mobility, specifically upper back. But I was talking with one of the members, and she gave me this great clue that her physical therapist had suggested that she put her foot up on a yoga block when she's at the kitchen sink to help relieve discomfort in her upper back. And so I was actually talking to her while I was in my stand-up desk, and I put my foot up, and it's like, so how does that work? I'm always one of how does that make it better? And if you have upper back issues or your back gets tired, I would challenge you to try it by just putting your foot up on the equivalent of the leg of a table or a yoga block specifically. It rotates your pelvis. It tilts it a little bit more posterior as you're standing there. Just enough that takes the pressure off your spine and it eases the discomfort in your low back. So it's not a huge raise. It's just a tiny little shift that gives you about, a centimeter, a half inch change in your pelvis rotation. A lot of times, I'll fiddle around with anterior pelvic tilt and try to find a neutral spine where your low back muscles are not engaged, or how to make your back so that your ears are over your shoulders and your shoulders are over your hips and your hips are over your knees and your knees are over your ankle, and trying to shift that way. But this little simple trick, just putting one leg up and then you can shift it, really makes a difference because it shifts your spine. The other thing is, where do you practice balance? And, you know, the worst thing that can happen to people as they get older, trip and fall, see if you're going to break something. And so when do you practice your balance, and what happens when you lift one leg or your other leg up? Do you shift? And again, with having had back issues and back spasms over the year with running and tight muscles here and there, we tend to get out of kilter. You know, even the most flexible people, if you do certain things more often than other things, you tend to kind of get shifted, or you get muscles that are contracted more in one way or the other, and you can get off balance. So recognizing if you're in the bathroom brushing your teeth or you know, whatever you're doing, you can actually look at your pelvis, your hips, to see whether or not when you raise one leg, are you shifting? Is it the same back and forth? Are you contracting your glutes? It's a good way to practice a little balance when you don't have to do, you don't have to specifically take time to do certain things. I have a yoga ball that I do my foot exercises, when I'm brushing my teeth in the morning. Again, I'll do a few balance exercises, when I'm getting ready in the morning. It may be putting one leg up against the wall to get a little glute activation early in the morning. But just little things like that help to maintain your balance and get you more aware of what your neutral spine is and how you might best correct it. So that little trick that with the yoga block kind of helped me find the place where I have more of a neutral spine that takes the pressure off my upper back. So I thought that was a good little cue. And, so always learn, and, just little subtle things can help out a lot. I like to do little stand-up exercises at my desk throughout the day. Some hip flexor stretches, hip mobility things that I can just stand up, a few squats that I can do right at my desk, shoulder mobility, reach up. I have, the yoga ball in my office, which is, they're soft. They're about the size of a softball that I can lean up against the wall and kind of get some of the kinks out from sitting, or being, run and then come to the office. Last thing I wanted to talk about today was actually immune function. Having good immune function is a sign of longevity. And we know that as we age, we lose natural killer cells, we lose immune function. And ultimately, that is what leads to our demise by getting an infection and not being able to recover from it. And there have been some studies, and one of the leading professors that writes on exercise and immunity is David Neeman, out of Appalachian State. And he has done several studies, but one that was very interesting to me, and I'll put a link to it, was looking at ultra running or long distance running and what does it do to your immune function. And we know that exercising for about an hour actually improves immune function by improving the release of different immune factors that help modulate the natural killer cells and macrophages and neutrophils. And the question is, when you exercise more than an hour, does it make it worse? And what he looked at was that I've talked about before, diabetics tend to have low-grade inflammation, and when you exercise and when diabetics exercise, they actually start to produce anti-inflammatory cytokines such as interleukin-1RA and interleukin-10, and they also decrease tumor necrosis factor. So if you are a diabetic or anybody and you exercise, you actually increase anti-inflammatory cell modulating proteins that actually decrease inflammation. But going over into the marathon and ultra distance, they've actually shown that for a period of time, you can actually have decreased immune function or be more susceptible to infections right after a big race or a marathon. And you know, the question is it harmful? Now, to date, that appears to be your immune function is improved while training. It goes down after a big race and then comes back up. But nobody knows over long periods of time. Nobody really studies it. You know, in the long run, does it make it better, or do you actually make it worse and perhaps decrease your immune function over time? I'm going to say no, it doesn't, because I'm an ultra runner and an endurance person. When they did, you know, some general questionnaire type studies, you know, most people that did endurance events felt healthier, felt like they had less colds. But there is a little time period after an event where people can be, you know, be a little bit more susceptible to an infection. And so they looked at what can you do to make it better. And one of the things that they found, vitamin C tends to help a little bit. Vitamin E didn't help that much. Glutathione, a lot of people think that they should be taking glutamate. Your muscles make it. There was never a correlation between glutamate and whether or not people got sick or better, and supplementing it didn't help. Vitamin C, again, helped a little bit. The studies didn't really give high-dose vitamin C. They gave ranges of 600 to 1,000 milligrams. For instance, COVID, you know, we're an infection, we're talking, you know, taking 10 grams. So I don't think that was high enough dose in some of those studies. But one of the interesting things was glycogen depletion. So when you completely deplete your glycogen stores, if that your glycogen stores were repleted, it tend to actually decrease the risk of infection. So again, it comes back to nutrition. As far as, you know, exercises improves immune function, if you overdo something, nutrition is your friend as far as improving it. And glycogen, which is glucose, which is carbohydrates, is exactly what returns immune function back to normal. So, you know, I'm going to go back to I told you so. After eating the big bowl of fruit after a marathon, I felt much better. Eating a lot, you know, eating the carbohydrate, the good carbohydrates that have not just glucose. So it doesn't mean just going and having Gatorade after an event or having sugar after an event that may be associated with, say, to eat a vegan cheesecake, which would have lots of sugar, but it would have lots of fat too. That's not going to do it for you because that's going to be inflammatory. But fruit with just all the antioxidants and vitamin C would be the perfect food to recover from significant exertional activities or races from. So again, if you're training and your training is increasing and you're entering new grounds or you have a race, make sure that you're recovering with foods that, just like they should be every day, very colorful, and having plenty of fruit. So I thought that was very interesting. I would love to be able to and maybe that'll be in my future, to try to amass a group of endurance athletes, and let's look over time what their immune function is long term, and especially plant-based athletes. So, you know, this is a good time to join the plant-based Striders so that we can amass a large group of plant-based endurance athletes to see how well we do compared to the general population after endurance events. I think I'm going to wrap it up tonight. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me at jamie@drdelaney.com. Visit our website at drdelaney.com. It's drdulaney. Love to hear from you. Share the podcast with other people so that they can have a listen. If you are interested in running with us next year, the Treasure Coast Marathon is our next group event, which will be next March. Training for that, we're training several people in our practice to run that race. But certainly, if you're going to be in Leadville, I'll see you then, and maybe I'll see you along the trail some other place. And again, if you're a runner or endurance athlete, I'd love to hear your story on the Facebook Plant-Based Striders. And thanks for listening. Go eat your fruit.